consequences. And by that point, this idyllic place of Eden has, they've been kicked out of it. And we start to see the ripple effects of their sin in chapter 4 when Cain kills Abel. And the rest of that chapter deals with the curse that is upon Abel and the consequences of his sin. And then it also tells us a little bit about his genealogy. So there's a contrast between the genealogy of Cain and then the descendants of Adam. And chapter 5 begins, this is the book of the generations of Adam, and then it goes on with a whole lot of begatten. And I want to jump down to verse 18 to the character that I want us to look at. Genesis 5, verse 18, Jared lived 162 years and became the father of Enoch. Then Jared lived 800 years after he became the father of Enoch, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Jared were 962 years, and he died. Enoch lived 65 years and became the father of Methuselah. Then Enoch walked with God 300 years after he became the father of Methuselah, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Enoch were 365 years. Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. He's the only one in that genealogy that doesn't say, and he died. He walked with God, and God took him. And so he stands out among all the people in the Old Testament as being, I can only think of a couple, I guess, Elijah, who God translates into heaven, where the death isn't recorded. There's no point made about his death, and it's connected with the idea that he walked with God. Now, as I said, Enoch's name is mentioned in five separate texts in the Bible. Three of them, I think, have a huge amount of significance. And I want to use those three texts to talk about three things that Enoch was remembered for. So we're not just going to talk about Enoch, but the things that he was remembered for when he does show up in the Bible. The first point I want to make is that Enoch is remembered because he walked with God. And that's the statement that's just made in verse 24. Now, Enoch is a word that means beginner. He's the son of Jared, the father of Methuselah. He's the seventh generation from Adam, and that may have some significance. It wouldn't bother me to think that there may be some gaps in this genealogy, that it may be structured in a certain way. We see other genealogies structured in various ways. Sometimes they skip generations. But the fact that he is the seventh generation, I think, has some bearing on the idea that he was, that his life was somehow significant. There is a significance attached to his life just by the place that he occupies on this. Now, the key idea, everything else about Enoch is pretty normal. You know, he's born to an earthly father. He lives so many years. He has a son named Methuselah. Presumably, that's his firstborn. And then he has other children. But the thing that stands out is we're told that he walked with God. Walking is a metaphor in the Bible for simply the path that you take in your life. The idea of that your life is a journey and you walk it in a particular way or on a particular path. If you look at other versions of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation of the Old Testament, instead of saying he walked with God, it says he was well-pleasing to God. And there's an early Aramaic Targum, just an Aramaic commentary on the book of Genesis, and it says he walked in the fear of the Lord. And both of those, I think, are good ways of understanding this idea of his walk with God. He walked with God. His life was perpetually before God. He feared God and shaped his life accordingly. One commentary says, figuratively living one's life in such a way that in faith one remains uninterruptedly conscious of the nearness of the Almighty God and so walks as the thought of that presence determines. And I actually think that's a pretty good way of thinking about it. The idea that we are always in the presence of God. Think back to Genesis chapter 3. Prior to Genesis chapter 3, man was in an intimate relationship with God, and God would apparently commune with Adam and Eve, and it was an open and free kind of thing. There was no hesitancy about it. There was no shame about it. There was no reservation about it. But then after Adam and Eve sin, what happens? They try to hide themselves from God. That openness, that walking in the presence of God, was no longer a comforting thing, it was a fearful thing. It was a thing that brought them shame and consternation because of their sin. Not so with Enoch. Enoch's walk was with God. He was constantly conscious of the presence of God, and it didn't bother him. In fact, he delighted in that. In everything that he did, he was conscious of the presence of God, and he walked accordingly. So it's talking about his intimacy with God. In contrast with so many other people that we read about in the Bible, so many people don't have intimacy with God. There is this estrangement. There is this enmity and hostility. With Enoch, there was intimacy. Think about all the songs that we sing that deal with the idea of intimacy with God. Nearer, my God, to thee. It's a song that is also a prayer. We want to be near God. A song that's in our hymnal, Walk With Me. It's an appeal to God to go with us on this journey of life. A song called Near to the Heart of God, where there is that place where we have this intimacy, where we can always go to Him regardless of the circumstances, regardless of what we're experiencing. Each step I take, my Savior goes before me, is what we sing. Another song is Nearer, Still Nearer. Another song, Just a Closer Walk with Thee. All of these songs reflect, I think, the desire that Christians should have, that our life is an open book before God. We have nothing to hide. There is no shame. And even when we do fail, we want God to inspect us. We want God to correct us. We want God to get us back on that path that maybe we have temporarily left. So when Enoch walked with God, it's not saying that he was perfect. It's just saying that he was intimate with God, constantly conscious of the presence of God, doing everything he was able to do to further that intimacy. And if there were occasions when that intimacy was interrupted, I get the sense that Enoch went back with God again. So the Bible talks a lot about this intimacy, about this fellowship that we are supposed to have with God. In the New Testament, Jesus spoke about this in John chapter 14. John chapter 14, it's the last night of Jesus' earthly life. You've got that extended section from John 14 through 17 where Jesus is preparing the apostles for his departure, talks a lot about their intimacy with him, talks about concerns that he has for them, talks about their concerns. In John 14, verse 23, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our abode with him. The idea of God dwelling with his people. We will make our abode. We will reside with the person who believes, with the person who loves God, with the person who keeps the word of God. That's walking with God. If we have that kind of fellowship with God, God is more than happy to make His abode with us. As Enoch walked with God, God walked with Enoch. There's a mutuality in that relationship. It's not one-sided. It's not just God scrutinizing us, looking for occasions when we stumble, but rather God knowing us, wanting us to know Him, and having that mutuality in the relationship. I talked about this metaphor of walking. That it's something that occurs quite a bit in the Bible. You see it a lot in the Old Testament. You see it in places in the New Testament. I want to just step through very quickly the book of Ephesians. The idea of walking is one of the most important words in that book. In the book of Ephesians, 8 different times, it talks about walking. For example, in Ephesians 2, in the opening verses, and you were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you formerly walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience. That passage reminds us that when we walk in sin, we're not united with God. It reminds us that there's one of two ways that you pick. If you're going to walk, you either walk in the path of sin or you walk on the path with God. And he says, as sinners, prior to our coming to Christ, if you're not with Christ, you're walking against Him. You're walking apart from Him in this world of sin and evil. In chapter 2, verse 10, for we are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand so that we would walk in them. Now, when we make the conscious decision to join ourselves with Christ and to leave the world, we're still walking. It's not as if we have stopped walking. You're always walking somewhere. Just a question of what path you're on. But once we start following Jesus, we are now on the path with Him. And God has prepared, He says, good works that we should walk in them. God is still conscious of the path that we walk. In chapter 4, verse 1, therefore, I, the prisoner of the Lord, implore you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which you have been called. We've been called out of the world of darkness into the light of the Son. We have been called out of the kingdom of the world to belong to the kingdom of Christ. And that's an invitation to walk in a particular way. Earlier he talked about walking in good works. Here he talks about walking in a manner worthy of our calling. We've been called by the gospel itself. And so the way that we walk in this world should reflect the nobility of the gospel. It should reflect the glory of God that He has revealed in the gospel. Our walk needs to reflect that. In chapter 4, 17, this I say and affirm together with the Lord, that you walk no longer just as the Gentiles also walk in the futility of their minds. I think it's significant that Paul here has to remind these Christians, you used to walk like this, now you walk like that. You used to walk in the world. Don't do that anymore. And the very idea that he exhorts them to continue walking, not as the Gentiles do, but to walk with Christ, the very fact that he even reminds them of that is a powerful suggestion that sometimes, if we're not careful, even Christians can sometimes wind up on the wrong path. We need to take seriously that every day we check where we are. Every day we make sure we're on the right path. Chapter 5, verse 2, he tells, verse 1 and 2, therefore be imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love, just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma. Chapter 5, verse 8, for you were formerly darkness, but now you are light in the Lord, walk as children of light. And then finally in verse 15, therefore, be careful how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise. All of this is commentary, I think, on the idea that Enoch walked with God. He was careful where he walked. He was careful how he walked. He was careful to maintain this conscious presence of God at all times. That's what it means to walk with God. When we say that Enoch walked with God, we're saying this is what he did. Now there's another question, how did he do it? I want you to turn now to the book of Hebrews, Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. Now it starts with a definition of faith. He says, now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen, for by it the men of old gained approval. So he says, I want to talk to you a little bit about faith. Now, he's just actually talked about faith. My righteous one, he says at the end of chapter 10, my righteous one, he's quoting the book of Habakkuk, shall live by faith. He shall not shrink back from persecution. In persecution, he persists to believe in God and to walk accordingly. And so he begins the chapter by saying, now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Faith has a substance. It has a foundation to it. Faith is not wishful thinking. Faith is not, as skeptics describe it, as a leap into the void. There's nothing void, there's nothing empty, there's nothing scary about faith. Faith has foundation, it's rooted in the existence of God and how He has revealed Himself to us. He says that this faith gives us hope. It gives us conviction about things. For by it men of old gained approval. And then starting in verse 2, by that little summary statement, he's telling us what the rest of the chapter is about. He's going to talk about men of old who gained approval by walking in faith. And so you get down to verse 5. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he would not see death. And he was not found because God took him up. For he obtained the witness that before being taken up, he was pleasing to God. So a couple of times in that verse, it talks about him being taken up. And the word that's used there means, it's metatithemi. Meta means to change, and tithemi means to put. Basically, it's a change of position. It's a transposition. The word's actually used in a lot of different ways in the New Testament. For example, in Acts chapter 7, which is Stephen's defense before the Jews. Acts chapter 7, down in verse 16. From there they were removed to Shechem and laid in the tomb which Abraham had purchased for a sum of money from the sons of Hamor. They were removed. They were transposed. They were taken from one place to another. That's a good description of what happens to Enoch. He was taken from one place to another. He was taken from his earthly dwelling to his heavenly dwelling. It's used in Galatians. In Galatians chapter 1, Paul is describing, has something to say about the Galatians themselves and what's happened to their faith. Galatians chapter 1, verse 6, I'm amazed that you are so quickly deserting him who called you by the grace of Christ for a different gospel. You've changed places, he says. You've deserted Christ. You've transposed what you did believe versus what you now believe. A change of location. In this case, a change of location that was not for good. And there's a few other places where this word occurs. I'm not going to read. But here in Hebrews chapter 11, it says, by faith, in verse 5, Enoch was taken up. This is how he lived his walk. He lived it by faith. He lived it trusting in God. He lived it with the firm conviction, not just of God's existence. In the very next verse, and without faith it is impossible to please him, for he who comes to God must believe that he is and that he's a rewarder of those that seek him. If Enoch was rewarded for his faith, what does that mean? It means he sought him, according to verse 6. It means he believed in the existence of God. He believed that God was a rewarder of those who seek him. And that is the reason why he walked by faith and thus was taken up. He was transported, transposed in his location. He was pleasing to God. His life was a daily testimonial to what he believed. I'll tell you what, we need to do that. Every day, does your life tell others what you believe? Do your friends, do your coworkers, do they even know what you believe? Sometimes that's a legitimate question. Have you lived your life in such a way that you have successfully hidden from your friends that you're a Christian? I hope not. But I know some Christians, that seems to be how they live out their lives. Nobody knows. Nobody knows what they believe. Nobody knows who they believe. Nobody knows how they live. Enoch's life was an open testimony to his faith. He believed in the one true God. He believed that this God is a God of grace because he rewards, but he's also a God of holiness because he expects people to seek him on his terms, not on man's terms. So to say that he lived a life of faith tells me a whole lot about Enoch. May not have a lot of verses to go on, but the few verses that we have speak volumes about the kind of man that he was. Think of all the people in the Old Testament who could have been singled out. Enoch is one of the first ones mentioned in this passage. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he would not see death. He obtained the witness that before his being taken up, he was pleasing to God. So you think about your own walk. Think about walking before God, constantly conscious of His presence, constantly conscious of the fact that He's interested in your life and how you're living it. Do you respond in faith? And is your life a testimony to all those who see you in your earthly walk? Is it a testimony to others that you believe in the one true God? Then the last verse that I want us to look at is from the book of Jude, the last text. This is the last place where Enoch is mentioned, the book of Jude. Now, Jude's a short book, but it's got a lot of challenging content in it. In the book of Jude, it's talking about false teachers. It's talking about those who had crept in unaware, as he says. He talks about those who have brought in a perverted gospel. They are undermining the faith of those who have listened to them and bought into their false message. He condemns them because of their sensuality, their love of fleshly things. They have perverted not only the message, but also the content of the Christian faith. They have perverted the morals of the Christian faith. And then he gives some examples from the Old Testament. And he comes around in verse 14. It was also about these men. So apparently Enoch experienced men like this in his day. Now, you think about the first 11 or so chapters of Genesis. We don't have a whole lot of information about what life was like. What did these people do from 9 to 5? What did they do for 900 years? I don't know. But this gives me a little bit of a glimpse that even men like Enoch, men who walked with God, men who took seriously faith in God, they had to combat false teachers. They had to combat men who did not teach and preach and practice the truth. So that tells me, as far back as you can go in human history, men knew the difference between right and wrong. Men knew the difference between serving God and not serving God. They knew the difference between sin and wickedness, or sin and righteousness. They knew the difference between those things. Now, what all God revealed to them, I don't really know. But a passage like that, these men are the kind of men that Enoch had to deal with. This is a very old problem. We lament sometimes about how bad the world is getting. Oh, it's bad. Always has been, though. And passages like this remind me, this is not a new problem. This is a very old problem. It goes back to the earliest strands of human existence. It is about these men that Enoch in the seventh generation from Adam prophesied. Tells me Enoch was a prophet of God. He spoke forth the will of God. Prophecy was not primarily about foretelling. It was primarily about speaking the will of God. So he knew the will of God, he practiced the will of God, and he spoke the will of God. So it says that he prophesied saying, "Behold, the Lord came with many thousands of his holy ones to execute judgment upon all and to convict all the ungodly of all their ungodly deeds which they have done in an ungodly way and of all the harsh things which ungodly sinners have spoken against him." What do you suppose the title of his sermon was? Something to do with ungodliness. Now, I don't know what he's talking about here when he says, "Behold, the Lord came with many thousands of his holy ones to execute judgment upon all." That's backwards looking. Now, someone might say, well, it's probably talking about the flood. Huh? Flood happened several chapters later, several generations later than Enoch. At some point, God came along with his holy angels and passed some kind of severe judgment against the sinners on earth. We typically look back to Genesis and say God had had enough. Well, apparently God had had enough before that too. Because he's looking backward at a time when, I don't know if he witnessed it himself, I don't know if this was handed down to him from previous generations, but he says at some point God came with his holy angels and passed a severe judgment on mankind. And the judgment was that ungodliness does not please God at all. Here's the message. The Lord came with many thousands of his holy ones to execute judgment upon all, to convict the ungodly of their ungodly deeds, which they have done in an ungodly way, and talking about all the harsh things which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. I get the impression that Enoch was against ungodliness. That's stating the obvious. What does he mean by ungodliness? I want you to look at the next verse. These, now the word "these" occurs twice there at the end. Well, actually several times in the chapter. Verse 12, "These are the men who are hidden reefs in your love feast." Verse 14, "These were the men that Enoch prophesied about." And then he says in verse 16, "These," so what are these ungodly people that he prophesied against? What is ungodliness according to this? These are grumblers, finding fault, following after their own lusts. They speak arrogantly, flattering people for the sake of gaining an advantage. The word ungodly means impiety or indifference toward God. How do you manifest indifference toward God? You might think, well, he's probably talking about atheists. No, actually, I don't think he is. You look at that list in verse 16, that sounds like a whole lot of people I know. Many of whom are not atheists. Many of whom claim to be Christians. That sounds a whole lot like Old Testament Israel. Now again, that's a couple of books down the road from Enoch. I don't know that he's talking about murderers and rapists and atheists and just the dregs of society. He's talking about ungodliness in all of its forms, and that includes the use of the tongue. Grumblers. Do you ever grumble? Be careful. Be careful how you answer that question. Do you ever grumble about things? When's the last time you were in a slow line at Walmart or Target? Or the last time you were in a drive-thru that should take less than about 5 minutes and it takes about 15 to 20 minutes? Did you grumble? Enoch and Jude say that's a form of ungodliness. They find fault. Well, let me tell you what you're doing wrong. Or you look at someone else. Well, let me tell you what they did wrong. They're constantly looking out for what others are doing, what others are doing wrong. They are fault finders. They follow after their own lusts. They speak arrogantly, flattering others for the sake of gaining advantage. They're full of themselves, and they appeal to the basest desires that there are. And pretty much every one of those things, you can find passages that do talk about atheists and very ungodly, unrighteous people, but sometimes these words are applied to God's people, because sometimes God's people are the ones guilty of these very things. Based on that list, are you godly or ungodly? Would Enoch have stepped on your toes had he been up here preaching on a given Sunday? That's the kind of ungodliness that he was addressing. My guess is that as he walked with God and told others about God, he probably told them, you know, there's some things you need to be doing differently. And I suspect he was a very lonely man as he walked with God, because not based on the content of what we just read in verse 14 and 15, there were a whole lot of ungodly people in his day. I think Enoch was probably a lonely man. He was probably considered a nuisance. But nonetheless, he walked with God. What he did was walk with God. Why he did it was he lived by faith, and how he did it was by avoiding ungodliness. That's Enoch. Enoch walked with God. Are you walking with God? Are you walking with God? That's what you do. Why you do it is because of your faith. How you do it is by living a godly as opposed to an ungodly life. You may have heard this story before. It's one of my favorites. A little girl was in Bible class one time, and they were studying the Old Testament, and they talked about Enoch on this given Sunday. And the teacher was just going around the room asking some questions about the story, and she said, "So, what does it mean that Enoch walked with God?" And this little girl raised her hand, and she said, "Well, what it means is that Enoch started walking and talking with God, and he walked and he talked, and he walked and he talked. And he and God kept walking and talking. And finally one day God turned to Enoch and said, you know what, Enoch? You're a whole lot closer to my home than you are yours. Why don't you just come home with me?" It's not a bad explanation. I hope that someday I will be so close to God's home that he'll say, just come on home with me. Just come on home with me. But that requires a whole lot of walking and a whole lot of talking with God, constantly reminded of his presence. Does that describe your walk with God? Think about that while we stand and sing.
Have thine affections been nailed to the cross? Is thy heart ripe with God? Dost thou count all things for Jesus but loss? Is thy heart ripe with God? Is thy heart ripe with God? Washed in the crimson flood, cleansed and made holy, humble and lowly, right in the sight of God. Hast thou dominion o'er self and o'er sin? Is thy heart right with God? Over all evil without and within, is thy heart right with God? Is thy heart right with God? Washed in the crimson flood, cleansed and made holy, humble and lowly, right in the sight of God. Are all thy powers under Jesus' control? Is thy heart right with God? Does he each moment abide in thy soul? Is thy heart right with God? Is thy heart right with God? Washed in the crimson flood, cleansed and made holy, humble and lowly, right in the sight of God.
You can be seated, please. I have just a few announcements.